And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is an exciting evening. I have Thomas Campbell on the line, and he's a physicist, and he's the author of My Big Toe, which is a series of three books. And although I didn't get an opportunity to read them, I think I understood most of what I was able to read. But Tom is actually coming into the Toronto area and is going to be doing a workshop in Toronto on August 22nd and 23rd, and I believe a screening on the 21st. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Lori. It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, Tom, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started on your journey? You've been at the Monroe Institute. I mean, you've done a lot of different things, but what kind of started you on this path?
Well, I really started becoming aware of a larger reality when I was in graduate school and started meditating with the Transcendental Meditation that was just kind of a rage at that time. This was back in 1970, I guess, and I did do the Transcendental Meditation, and I found an amazing thing that I could debug software. I could debug the code that I was writing much faster in a meditative state than I could if I were actually sitting over the code and looking at the printouts and trying to figure out what was wrong. So I knew that there was something going on here that was absolutely real and significant, even if I didn't have any idea what. Then after I got out of graduate school, I took a job, and my boss introduced me to Bob Monroe's book, Journeys Out of the Body. And then it turned out that within a few months of that, I got a chance to go meet Bob. He lived actually in the same area where I was working, so out I went to see Bob, and Bob was in the process of building a laboratory to study out of the body. Out of body phenomena was just something that happened to Bob, and he really didn't want it to happen to him. You know, it was a very scary thing for him. He tried to not have it happen, but he was destined to go this route, so it happened anyway. So he decided to play with it and see what it was like, and found out that he could do things. He could gather information. He could experience things and see things that he could verify later is absolutely real in this reality. And it kind of went from a scary thing to more of a tool, and he explored it, and then he wrote these books, and then eventually he didn't want to be the crazy old guy that did funny things. He wanted to be a part of something that was normal, something that was rational, and he wanted to study it so he could pass it on to other people, something that that he could contribute. So that's about where I came in. He had just built this lab and hadn't actually didn't have any equipment in it. It was just a shell of a building. And he was looking for some scientists to help him, man his lab and do the protocols and generate the equipment and that sort of thing. And that was just a perfect match. So I did that for Bob, and the deal was that I would work for him for free, and he would teach me what he knew about out-of-body. So that's what happened then over the next 6 or 7, 8 years. Spent maybe 20, 30 hours a week out at Bob Monroe's, and he would teach me out-of-body techniques as he knew them. And I would practice those, and I would build his equipment and lab. And it wasn't just me. There were others involved in it. Dennis Menerick was another one who was at that same meeting and also agreed to help Bob like this. So that's where it all started. So that was now with Bob was back in like 1972. And I've been working at it ever since. This is not something that once you learn that you can just kind of
turn off.
Well, that was fun and put it down and walk away from. This is an adventure that once you start, you keep going, and it's a lifelong study and adventure.
Well, I think you've definitely accomplished a great deal as well as understood a lot more than the average person with regards to out of body, but not just out of body. You certainly have gone well within many of the spiritual realms and have a deep understanding about the physical reality as well. So let's talk a little bit about, let's first start with the non-physical. You talk a little bit about how the non-physical is all about metaphors and symbols, and how we bridge our experience what we experience with our personal experiential database. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, that is correct. Well, first, I'd have to say that one has to understand that the larger reality, and I say larger, which means it's bigger than just the physical reality that most of us are familiar with, the larger reality is consciousness. Consciousness
right.
is the only thing that's fundamental. Everything else is virtual. So this physical reality one is really a virtual reality, and we are consciousnesses, units of consciousness that are experiencing this reality, and we experience it basically as data. So that's another big step, and kind of saying these things out of context is going to be hard for your listeners maybe to appreciate it. But there's a lot of descriptive detail and derivation that are in the books to understand them better. But this reality is just data.
Yeah.
Okay, consciousness is a non-physical information system, a digital information system at that. Now, this is my model of consciousness, but it seems that this model tends to answer most of the mail and connects most of the dots as far as what we know about consciousness, from Eastern metaphysics to physics. So anyway, getting back to your question with that kind of as a background, so you're a consciousness and you're receiving data. Going into a different reality frame is just a matter of switching data stream. So there's a data stream that defines physical matter reality, and then there's data streams that define other reality systems. But you're still a consciousness, and if you're doing this projection from the physical matter reality going out of body, because you're here in this reality, have a body, then you are limited to what you can understand to things that you've experienced. You can't describe things that are beyond your experience. You have to describe anything, even if something you haven't experienced yet. You must describe it in terms of your own experience. That's just the way it is. So there's a limitation, is the amount of experience you have. And another one is your beliefs. You will only understand something within the restrictions of your beliefs. If it runs outside your belief system, then you can't grasp it. You don't understand it. You'll make up some other kind of reason or explanation for it, because in your mind it just is impossible. And when we run into the impossible, we tend to come up with something inside of our experience that makes it sound possible. So what that means is, if you're out in these reality frames and you experience something out there, you will interpret that something in terms of your experience and within the constraints of your belief systems. So that's why explorers go out and they come back with all sorts of different stories, and it seems like none of them are quite in the same reality, because it all comes back a little different. Well, that's because not what they're experiencing is necessarily so terribly different, but the way they interpret it is different. We each walk around in our own reality. Reality is individual. And when you come back from one of these adventures and you describe to other people, you have to put it into language. You have to put it into, if you're in the U.S. like I am, you put it into English. And just the process of putting it into English is a restriction, because you only have a language that was developed to describe and communicate about the physical world and events and things in that physical world. So you have all these restrictions. So what you get out the other end, which is the description of, hey, this was my adventure, you have to take it, the literal words, with a grain of salt. It has a lot to do with that individual's interpretation. But if you can read beyond the literal words and see what was the significance, what was the meaning, what was the connections there, then you'll find that many explorers are talking about the same things. So I hope that's an understanding. It's a little hard to describe these things without the background of having read the books, but hopefully that'll be something your listeners will be able to get hold of.
Yeah. I it's funny. I had this interview, and she said the most incredible thing, which, makes perfect sense. We're on a tiny little planet with 6.8 billion people, and there's really only one message, but it has 6.8 billion different interpretations of that one message. And that's really what you're saying, is that we're all so individuated in our consciousness.
Another way to say that is there is but one truth. There is only one truth. There is one, you know, one consciousness system, and that consciousness system is fundamental. But there are, you know, there are many interpretations of it, you know, as there are people.
Yeah.
And all of the various groups that have their own interpretations, and some of them have to do with you know, religious things, like the Hindus. They have their own interpretation. They see the, you know, eight plane or seven planes and you know, chakras and all the rest of this. This is their own model for that reality. But it is just a model.
Mm-hmm.
Things like chakras are just metaphors. Now, that doesn't mean that they're false. It just means that you can't take them literally. They can still be very effective tools for understanding.
Right.
That doesn't, you know, you have to not think that because they're metaphors that they're just, you know, like fake or not useful. That's not the case. They're very good ways for understanding the larger reality. But they're just metaphors. They're just a way of talking about it.
Because reality is this physical body isn't really here. So how could the chakras be there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's that's one way to look at it. But yeah, the chakras do describe, you know, energy, and they break it into pieces and functions, but they don't have to be broken into those pieces and functions.
Right.
You can break it up differently, and when you break it up differently, you see it differently.
Yeah.
Because you're interpreting the information. You see, when we go to an out-of-body state and we look and say, well, I saw this and I saw that, well, you don't really have eyes if you don't have a body.
Right.
What is it that you're seeing? Well, what you're doing is you're getting data, you're interpreting that data, and that interpretation has to be, again, in terms of your experience, which is all sense-based.
Right.
So you turn it into what you saw and heard and smelled and felt, but that's your interpretation. It was just data when you got it. And it's the same for a lot of things that people kind of hold sacred in the, you know, in the, I don't know, I wouldn't say New Age, but in the metaphysical community.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, light, energy, right? We talk about energy bodies and we heal with light. All those things are just metaphors. It's data that's being exchanged, and it's intent that heals. It's intent of a consciousness that modifies the larger consciousness system. So you can modify, you can affect other consciousness, other data streams with your intent. But the light, the energy bodies. Now I see energy bodies too. You know, that's, I look at a person and I can see bodies that represent their emotional body and their physical health body and their spiritual body and all these things. But all those visions are is just data. I'm putting out inquiries about their physical health or their spiritual state or something, and I get the answers back in graphical form or in picture form.
Right.
And then those are the energy bodies that I see. And most of us see kind of similar things because most of us interpret things in similar ways. So if we're all kind of part of the same culture and we've read the same books, then we tend to come up with very similar interpretations. So we all agree on these energy bodies and the colors and what they mean and the chakras and where they are and what they look like, because, you know, it's kind of a shared thing, a group consciousness, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But that they're still just metaphors, just models of the information received.
Right. Can we go into that a little bit more? I mean, I do remember somebody saying to me, well, you know, because usually we say, you know, everything is energy. We can, you know, look at it through a microscope. If we break it down far enough, you know, we see the space, we see, you know, that's energy. So we've tried to, I guess, define energy and to, for all of us to see energy. But if you're saying that it's really data, that's a little bit different than energy.
Yeah, it's data. Now, let me get the perspective right, though. I'm talking about consciousness. In this physical reality, we have a physical rule set that sets up, you know, the way the data comes in. It's like a computer game. You know, there's a game my son plays called World of Warcraft that is a virtual reality game. And in that virtual reality game, people cannot just do whatever they please. There's certain rules there that you have to abide by. You know, your character falls into water and you don't know how to get him to the surface, he'll drown, you know, and there's certain ways that people have to interact and so on. That's the rule set that defines that reality. Our reality, our physical reality, has a rule set, and that's our physics. that defines this reality. So you have to operate within the physics to be within the rule set, and that's kind of a general term. And in this rule set, we know that this term energy is the thing that makes things happen. Okay, that's what we call it. It's the, you know, things don't move, they don't change, nothing happens if we don't have energy. Energy is the, you know, the what shall we say, the thing that creates change, makes stuff happen. Well, we go and then into the consciousness realm, and we see that we can project a light beam onto something that is diseased, and we can cure it in the consciousness realm. Well, we've just made something happen. So what do? We make an analogy. We make a metaphor and say, well, that's energy.
Okay.
Because energy describes it very well, because that's what we're used to here in this physical matter reality, that energy is what's required to change things. So that's a natural way of doing it. And we also tend to be visual. How do you know, we have this belief that in order to affect something, you have to do something, because that's the way it is here in a physical reality. So you can't just look at that diseased tissue and say, presto changeo, go away, because that won't help you focus your intent. Your intent is to heal it. And the way we focus our intent is with heals, with tools. I mean, the way we focus on healing is with tools. So we use a tool like a beam of light. Now that's our device that goes there to that illness and does something to it. It burns it, or it changes it from dark to light. It has some effect, and that's just a reflection of our belief that you have to do something to make something happen. And that's a belief, again, it's just a habit of physical reality. That's not necessary. You don't need light. You don't need, you don't actually need tools if you can do without them. But most of us can't, because we're so habituated to the beliefs of a physical matter reality that we need those tools to help us focus our intent on a very specific thing happening.
Because in a way, we're still seeing it as outside of ourselves versus,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not seeing it as all part of one big thing, that it's all consciousness, and you're a part of consciousness, and you are interacting with consciousness with your intent. It's all mind, if you want to say it that way. Mm-hmm. So it's the physical caricatures of it. We see the energy bodies, and they sort of look like people. You know, they're kind of humanoid in shape. They're kind of taller than they are wide. At least that would describe most of us, I think. And they kind of look like people, and you know, we then put energy on them, and we do things that match with our own anatomy. And none of that's absolutely necessary, but that's kind of common tools. You know, when we meet an entity out in this non-physical, you know, if it's Uncle Fred, then he's wearing clothes like Uncle Fred wore. You know, bib overalls or, you know, a snazzy hat or whatever. And that's how we recognize him, partly as Uncle Fred. And if we don't recognize this person, if it's somebody we've never met or before, how do we dress them?
Right.
Put a robe on them. Why? Because that's just kind of a nondescript. That's the default value. So all of these people have to wear robes, if you've noticed. None of them go naked. Gee, I wonder why that is. So we take our own values and our own experience, and we interpret things out there. So in a place where there are no physical bodies, we still need to clothe them properly. Otherwise, we can't interact with them properly.
Right.
So there are no, of course, in these non-physical bodies, there are no body parts because there is no body. But we see them that way because when we think of an entity that we're communicating with, this is how we interpret an entity. We interpret it as a humanoid. And here's another interesting thing. You know, if you'll notice from the people who travel in the larger reality, most all the good guys are humanoid. You know, they have heads and arms and legs and, you know, things like that. They look just like us. And all the monsters aren't. You know, they're something else. They may have three heads, you know, or pointy ears or something else that shows that they're different. So again, this is just an artifact of our interpretation. So is this making sense?
Absolutely. You talk about how we're mostly relationship-centered. So we have a set of actors, ideas, which is the data, and of course we experience that through our consciousness, not our senses.
Now the way that description comes about is first you have to understand what we're here for. We're in this physical matter reality, and let me describe a little bit so your listeners will get an idea that maybe this makes more sense than it sounds like. You know, think about your data input that creates your reality. So people are sitting out there listening to this. You know, they're in a room someplace. They're in a car. They're in a house. They have access to a computer or some such thing. And they have, you know, they have things coming to their eyes. It's light coming to their eyes. Whatever their room looks like, whatever their computer and computer screen looks like, wherever they are, they're hearing sounds. They're getting light waves that get focused on the retina and get turned into little, you know, bits of information on the optic nerve. And little bits of information are neurons. These are discrete particles and electric signals. And the same with their hearing and their smell and everything else. It all turns into just neurons and electrical signals, little discrete bits of information.
Hmm.
So now if you took that individual and put them in a place that had a complete sensory deprivation, where, you know, a deep dark hole, as I sometimes say, and then you could feed them these signals into their nerves. If you could stimulate their nerves in the exact same way that they're stimulated right now, well, they would see and hear and smell and feel the exact same things.
Hmm.
So that gives you a sense of the idea that your reality is really just data that you interpret. Okay, now, so here we are. We're entities, and we're plugged into this physical matter reality, and we're receiving data that basically is just like that data I said. It's stimulating, you know, all of our nerves, except we really don't have nerves. It just is coming to us. We interpret it to be this physical reality that we see. It's the interpretation, and this is a multiplayer game, just like World of Warcraft. So we interact with other players. And the purpose of this game, why we're here and why this virtual reality exists, is it's a training center, if you will. It's a learning lab. It's a virtual reality trainer. You know, pilots go into virtual reality trainers where they learn their skills of how to survive unexpected, you know, serious events. They can't do this in a real plane. They're not going to go up in a real plane and then set an engine on fire so they can practice, you know, what do you do when an engine catches on fire. So they do these in simulators. They get into a virtual reality simulator, and it's just like being in the plane. It looks like a plane cockpit that's got all the controls and buttons, and they have to interact. It's got a view out the window that looks like the ground and the sky and the clouds, and it's very realistic, and they have to push all the right buttons and do the right things to bring that plane in with an engine on fire without crashing it. And that's how pilots learn to do these things, not in real planes. Well, that's a virtual reality trainer. Well, we're in a virtual reality trainer here in this physical reality. That's what our physical reality is, and the point of it is for us to learn and grow, for us to grow up, to become love. In my books, I talk about entropy, to lower the entropy of our consciousness. But that would be the same thing as saying improving the quality of our consciousness, evolving our consciousness, spiritual growth, becoming love. All these things are synonymous. So that's really the point of being here. So we're in this interactive virtual reality. And what is it that's primary about learning? Where do our challenges and lessons come from? Well, they come from interactions with people, interactions with Critter. It's not, if you just go and go into a deep, dark cave and sit there, cross your legs and meditate, you're cutting yourself off from a lot of the interactions that actually help you grow, help you get rid of the ego, help you get rid of the self-focused ideas, make you more aware of your interactions with others. That's what we're here for. So yes, it's about relationship. It's about people. It's how you interact with those people. If one of those persons does something nasty to you, do you get mad and get even? Or do you understand and try to deal with it in a positive way? So yes, that's what it's all about. We're here in this learning lab, and it's not about engines on fire. It's about the quality of our consciousness. We're evolving, and we're evolving that quality. And that means we are becoming more love-like. So now you're beginning to see how this ties into the metaphysics, both East and West.
Mm-hmm. So we're part of this one consciousness, but we have our individuated consciousness, and we also have, there's one in between, which is like the higher self, that's something within us. So, and it's all about choices, and it's our intent and it's our learning potential.
That's it. You've done a very good summary of it. And I might add that this consciousness system is just a natural system that has evolved. Don't think of the consciousness system as something that's beyond the rules that the rest of us deal with. It's also evolving. It's changing. It's not a perfect system. It's not an infinite system. It's a finite system, and we are a part of that evolving system, and we help it evolve by evolving our own little piece of it. So it evolves through us in some measure.
Yeah. And that certainly has been, you know, the message that's been coming out. But is there, you know, I mean, our little piece of it is so finite, more than, you know, the one that we're not really, I guess, that fear is what is prohibiting us from reaching that potential of love within ourselves to connect with that higher consciousness or that larger one consciousness. To imagine that it's, you know, you're saying that it's finite as well, in that it's not infinite, it's not, even though it's growing, it kind of boggles the mind, because it's, and I guess that's the whole point, to try and get you out of the mind, to try and just to experience the beauty of what it is.
That is a very good way to say it. Yes, that's kind of what we're doing. You know, it's evolving, and we're a piece of it that's evolving, and we're part of that evolution. It's not like we're separate things. It's like, well, there's this big consciousness system, and then we're these separate little parts over here that are different. That's not it. We are separate in the sense that we have our own experience base and our own free will, and we are what I call individuated units of it. But think of that as just subsets. We're just little subsets of it, and the reason we're individuated like that is because that's how you parallel process this evolution. You see, otherwise, if you just had one big consciousness system and no individuated consciousness, then you'd have one big monolithic system that was trying to evolve. Well, how would it do that? How would it interact? What is it going to interact with? How is it going to create all of these possibilities and choices and things that are required for consciousness to grow, for consciousness to, lower its entropy? Well, the strategy to do that is to create all these smaller units of consciousness that then you set free to interact with each other. So that's just part of the system. We are the system, and the system is us. The big reality is, as you say, the one in capital letters, and that's consciousness. And we are a part of that. And we are consciousness as well. That's why we can change things with our intent, because we also have the same kind of abilities that consciousness everywhere has. And consciousness, I should say, is not just limited to people. You know, dogs and cats are conscious, and birds and bumblebees. There's anything that is sentient, which means it can react to stimulus, you know, has a little bit of consciousness. But all consciousness are not equal. There's a thing I call decision space, and that's the amount of decisions, kind of the decisions that an entity can make. Now, if you're a bumblebee, you have just, you know, very few decisions that you really can make. And most of what you do is you just act kind of instinctually, or, you know, the way your biology drives you. But there are some decisions you get to make, but it's a small set. As a person, you have a much larger, much richer set of choices, and therefore a much richer opportunity to grow that consciousness. But all things sentient are conscious.
You go into, when you talk about virtual realities, about, you know, everything that could possibly happen, especially when it's associated probability will happen. It's about the future and the probable future, and that everything that we think is going to happen, especially if it has to do with our own growth, is definitely going to happen.
Well, let me go into that a little bit. You know, in the Hindu and other Eastern cultures, you have this idea of Akashic records. You know, that's where you kind of have this database where everything happens. Well, as it turns out, that really is a database. It's just a database because consciousness is an information system. And you have three fundamental databases. And you also have the present, which is just a moment. So the three databases are, one, you have the probable future. And that's all the things that could possibly happen, along with the probability of them happening. Okay, so some things are more likely to happen than others.
Right.
First maybe I need to say how this reality gets generated. The reality, just like World of Warcraft, has to be run on a time basis. So our reality is given its own time. It's not a general time, but it's our own time for this reality. Time is different when you get out of this reality. So in our reality, every delta T, every little increment of time, you kind of update the screen, if you will. You update where everybody is and all the decisions they make and, you know, that sort of thing, how they interacted. So as a probable future, you're basically just extrapolating out in time. You're saying, well, what was likely to happen this next delta T? Now, we haven't gotten to that time increment yet. It hasn't happened. It's not moved into the present yet. But what's likely to happen there? Well, you look at all the history of all the things and all the events, and you can predict pretty much what's going to happen in this delta T. Now, this delta T is only about a billionth of a second in our time, so this is a very short time. And it's probably not too hard to guess what's going to happen in that short of time. And a lot of its present trends continue. So in any case, then you say, well, given that we were right on that one, what happens in the next delta T after that? So again, you look at all the probabilities, you pick the most probable states, and you say, well, to these most probable states, that's what's going to happen after that. And then you just keep going out, well, what might happen in the delta T after that? So you do this, and you can go out just as far as you want, but the further out you go, of course, the rattier your answers are, because you're basing one set of assumptions, you know, on the last set of assumptions. So that's the probable reality database, though. It's this set of projected delta T increments that are in our virtual reality here, our simulation, and they are everything that possibly could happen, and they're are assigned a probability of the likelihood of that happening. And now we have the present. So in the present, we have free will. We get to make choices. And we choose some state. And most of it is probably like predicted, but some of it isn't. And that isn't then changes, and all those probable realities all have to adjust because they're based off of, you know, what's likely to happen next. And if you do something unusual, then what's likely to happen next is different than than what was predicted. So that's one database. So then there's the present, where you actually have free will. You make the decisions, the choices that we have to make that allow us to lower our entropy or evolve our consciousness or not. And then all of this information goes into two past databases. The things we actually do, the things we actually implement, the choices we make, go into what I call the actualized history. That's what we did. So that's everything we did. But then all the rest of that probable reality out there, the things that could have been done but weren't, choices that could have been made but weren't made, they all go into the past, unactualized past. Those aren't things that we actually chose to do, but they were possibilities. So now you have three databases. You have the probable future, you have the actualized past, and you have the unactualized past, and all these databases are just out there, and that's what makes up these Akashic records, and you can basically query those databases with your intent, and that's what we do when we're, say, looking at somebody's health aura. We have an intent that says, I'd like to see, you know, what's unhealthy, and I'd like to see it like this. I'd like all the things that are real healthy to be bright white. I've got this humanoid shape in my mind, and I'd like all the things that are unhealthy to be black. Well, you've given it the output format. You've asked for data, and you get the data, and you interpret it just the way you called it out. So we are dealing with these databases all the time, and when you get into these databases, it's just like stepping into a movie. It's there. It's real. You can see people interacting. You can see stuff happening. You can visit the past this way. You can visit the future this way. That's where the precognitive dreams come from. They get into the future probable database, and they can see it just like watching a movie, just like they were there, and they can interact with it. You can get into these databases, and let's say you get into a past non-actualized database, and you can say, well, gee, what if it was this way? What if I had done that? Or what if this didn't exist? And it'll go ahead and play out the movie for you based on that set of assumptions, because it's got all the possibilities in there, so we can play it out any way your intent asks it to. So that's kind of the basic idea of these databases. And now the characters that are in these databases are basically models of you. But now what are you? You're really a subset of data and information. That's what we are at root, because that's what consciousness is, and we're a part of consciousness. So in these databases, you have that same data set in there defining an individual, and it stays in there. But there's one difference. In the past, those data sets don't have free will. They're not making choices. They're just going through the motions of exploring the possibilities. Whereas in the present, that's where free will is. That's the only place you have free will. That's where the action is and the real choices are making that affect your growth. Okay, well, is that clear, or have I just effectively, you know, confused the heck out of you?
No, I'm really enjoying this. I think it's great. And so it's our choices that we need to really understand. And you talk about, you know, the point of the system is to overcome fear and to replace it with love. And you also say, you know, a little bit later on that, you know, fear is, it's not like you can act. It's not about acting. It's not about acting as if you have no fear. It's about eliminating it.
Absolutely. It's a, you know, to grow up doesn't have anything to do with appearances. It has to do with the way you are. In fact, in our reality frame, what you do or don't do is not particularly relevant. It's the intent that's behind that doing or not doing. That's what's irrelevant, or that's what's relevant, excuse me. So it's the intent that's relevant. What you actually do, you know, that's the action, that's the image, that's what it looks like. For instance, if, you know, we just give a little kind of a ethical situation where the actions are identical but the intents are quite different. What if you were walking behind someone and you noticed that, you know, a $20 bill dropped out of their pocket and laid on the ground? Now, if you were a person that worried about being caught and you said, well, I could grab that up and nobody would notice, but then you notice there are kind of people standing around, and so you pick it up and you give it back to them, and the reason you give it back to them really is that you really wouldn't want to be caught stealing this person's money. So that's your intent. Whereas another person sees the $20 on the bill, says, oh, this person lost this. Excuse me, sir, is this yours? Or this is yours because I saw it fall out of your, you know, see, there's two different motivations there. Now the actions are the same. Both times the person looked, saw the dollar or the $20 bill that came loose. Both times they picked it up. Both times they returned it. But you see, the intent was very different.
Mm-hmm.
One was a growing intent, one that expresses a lower entropy. The other one was based on fear, but the actions were the same. So that's you can generalize that to everything we do. It's not that you act nice to people. It's the fact that you are nice when you interact with people. It's not about how you act. It's about what you are. And you don't lower entropy. You don't grow up. You know, you don't pass go and get $200 unless you're changing your being. Just acting the part is irrelevant. That's ego. And fear is the opposite of love. You know, I was talking about, well, we're growing toward love. A low entropy consciousness is love. That's the definition of love. And the opposite of love is fear. Fear is where the ego comes from. Fear is where the self-centeredness comes from. It's, you know, we think that hate is the opposite of love, but that's not it. Hate is a creation of fear. Fear is the fundamental opposite of love.
You know, it's I use that analogy all the time because I have believed that for quite some time now. It's amazing though how many people, when I say it, oh, you know, you're reacting out of fear, and they say, well, I'm not reacting out of fear. What are you talking about? I'm not afraid of something. And then it's really hard to try and explain, you know, where the fear is coming from, because they're not understanding the concept. Because when some people hear the word fear, it means that they're going into a, you know, this fearful state, or, you know, they don't see anger as being fear. They don't see, jealousy is being feared. Like it's hard for them to conceptualize.
Yeah, that's because they're only looking at fear as like fear of bodily harm. All right, I'm afraid if somebody's going to, you know, hit me with something. But that's, you know, fear is much more general than that. It's the fear of being inadequate. It's the fear of not being lovable. It's the fear of people not liking you. It's the fear of not fitting in, and the you know, it's those kinds of things is where the anger. It's the fear that has to do with me not getting, you know, my share. You know, I'm afraid I won't get my share. That sort of thing. That's where a lot of the anger comes from, and a lot of the self focused. Yeah, it all comes from basically from fear.
Yeah. So how do we improve this quality of consciousness? How do we, you know, because you say, you know, on this planet, we're very, very accustomed to wearing masks. We're very good at hiding our feelings and who we really are. So good that we really don't know who we are. And then you say when you're in the non-physical, you know, it's all about feelings. You have to be authentic. That's not, you know, and being authentic, especially for women, really challenging.
Yes, you know, women have a kind of a special, I mean, both the sexes have their own kind of special needs and ego markers, but women have more of an issue with feeling insecure and inadequate and not sure whether or not they're doing what they should be doing or measuring up to what they think they should be. They tend to feel more that way than most of the guys do. The guys have their own thing where they're more concerned about they're not in charge, they're not able to, you know, provide the living or get the job or do the thing out in the outside world. Guys are focused on the outside world. They're there to kind of in their sense to manipulate the physical world around them, that outside world, and make it, you know, make it good for them and theirs. And women live in the inside world. Theirs is a world of relationship. Mm-hmm. It's about interaction and being and connections. And so that just makes them see things. They have a little different, you know, view on reality because they come from such different perspectives. But yes, you're right. You know, people don't understand this fear thing. And when it comes, what do you do about it? How do you change? Mm-hmm. Well, first thing, I guess the very first and most important requirement is that you need to want to change.
Mm.
So to begin with, you have to realize where it is, you know, who you are, what you're doing, why you're here, what the point is, and then try to make some effort to grow up, to evolve your consciousness. And that kind of comes to the point, well, I want to change, I want to grow up. And if you don't get to that point, if you're just here to make money, have fun, and, you know, watch TV and drink beer, then you're not going to change very much. I mean, you'll still grow a little just because you interact and you get feedback. You know, if you're nice, then people are nice to you. And if you're not, they're not. And you'd like to be people are nice to you. So then you act nice, and that's just acting perhaps. But if you act enough and you really want to be nice, if you want it more than an act, then you can grow up without really trying in a sense. But that's the slow path. And that takes a very, very long time. It's tiny little steps. If you want to make more progress than that, then you have to actually be active in your evolution of your consciousness. You have to desire to grow up. And then you have one of the ways to do that. There's lots of techniques for that. One is being in the present, to where you stop this constant judging and analyzing everything, and you just live and interact honestly from the heart in the present. That's a technique. Another would be to be very aware of your motivations, of your intent. Forget about the actions, but why are you doing what you're doing? Why is that important? You know, you interact with other people, and you want to go right, and other people want to go left. Why is it so important that you go right? Why is it so important that they're going left? What is the dynamics of the interactions here? And what would love do? Put it that way. You know, what would love do? What's the right way to interact here that is to the advantage of the most people? So it's just a matter of awareness for the most part.
Yeah.
And desire. You want to do better, and you're aware of what you're actually doing. And living in the moment is a great way of stimulating that awareness. And you know, some people, of course, I got here through the out-of-body route, and I developed these ideas and this model of reality, you know, with physics background and that sort of thing. But you don't have to do any of these things. You never have to go out of body, and you never have to experience anything paranormal at all in order to grow.
Right.
You can grow the quality of your consciousness without, you know, doing or touching any of those things. They're just there because you are consciousness. All this is available to you. So you can learn to do these things. You can do them, but they're not required for growth.
Right. But you also say that, you know, providing an environment that helps others improve their quality of consciousness is also a way for us to improve our consciousness.
Absolutely. You know, the most important thing you can do is improve your own self, because you are responsible for you, and everybody else is responsible for improving themselves. And we all realize eventually that you can't really force anybody to learn anything. You can't make someone see something or someone learn something.
No.
It has to come from the inside. So all you can do to help people is to provide an environment where it's easy for them to learn, as opposed to one that makes it difficult for them to learn. So that's really the best thing you can do for other people, to go to somebody and say, hey, listen, you need to do it this way, or this is the right answer. You know, you have to approach life from this direction. That's useless. You cannot get people to grow or understand by lecturing them.
Yeah.
You have to encourage them, and you have to give them an opportunity to do it on their own. And that's about as much as you can do.
Well, let's digress a bit and talk about the ego and how, you know, it's very self-defined. It's about separation and differentiating from others. And it's all fear. Like, how do we, you know, there's definitely a movement out there where, you know, you have to get rid of your ego, and you have to have a death of the ego, and you have to, you know, completely detach from it. And then there's the other where they're believing that, you know, I think in this reality, the ego is very much part of it. And I don't know if you can really get rid of it. I think you find a way to embrace it and love it for the child that it is, possibly. But I don't know if you really ever get to that state here that you don't have an ego, but I don't know.
Well, there's a confusion there that most people have. If you get rid of ego, that doesn't mean that you get rid of the sense that you exist. That doesn't mean that you no longer see yourself as an individual. That doesn't mean that you no longer have passion, or that you no longer care, that you're just this kind of floating above it all and you're not engaged in anything. That's not what getting rid of ego is. Getting rid of ego means getting rid of intents that are self-focused. It means that you do things for love rather than for, you know, out of fear.
Mm.
That is what getting rid of ego means. So you can live you can have no ego here and lead a very nice life. Matter of fact, we sometimes run into people who have very little ego, and they're so nice, and everybody just loves to, you know, be around them, and that's because, you know, they are radiating love. They're not being judgmental. It's not, you know, they're not in the, well, what about me, you know, and you need to do this for me, or you need to feel this way about me. And if it's always about you, which is, you know, you being, again, yes, separate from everybody else, but separate's just a part of it. You know, separate is kind of our perspective from this rule set. We are separate because we need that separateness so we can interact. We need the interaction so we can learn. So the separateness is just part of the rule set of being here. We're going to feel like we're separate people, even though the fact is we're all part of the same consciousness system. But it's how that intent, it's the reasons why. If the reasons why have to do with you, well, the reason I do this, or the reason I'm talking to you, is because, you know, I think you can help me, or the reason that I married you is because, you know, I needed the services that you could provide. You know, if it's all about the individual, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, but why don't you scratch mine first, because that way I make sure I won't get a bad deal. That sort of thing is all ego-based, and that's what we're trying to get rid of, that self-referential, fear-based stuff. And yes, ego is a is just a product of the fear. Fear is the fundamental boogeyman, so to speak. Fear is the basic problem, and out of that fear, you know, ego is the result of a fearful intent.
Okay, let's talk about guides. Now, you also say that they're a metaphor, but that they provide, you know, specifically our needed growth opportunities, valuable learning experiences, and nudge us in the right direction.
Yes, guides are a metaphor, and I know that'll hit people funny, and they'll say, oh, I've had these guides for 50 years, and I talk to them, and we're on a first-name basis, and they answer my questions, and they're always the same, and, you know, how could this be a metaphor? Well, it's a metaphor for the way or the mechanism that the larger consciousness system helps us evolve. I said that the larger system is evolving, and it is, you know, it's in its interest that we evolve. We're part of it. It evolves partly through our evolution. So it wants us to succeed. You know, it only makes sense because, you know, we're on its path to success. Our success is its success. So the system is set up to be helpful to us to succeed. And part of that process of helping us to succeed is this interface we have with the larger system called guides. It's not that a guide is a humanoid kind of being that sits in the clouds, watches our every move, and then, you know, whispers in our ear and tells us when to duck, and, oh, no, that wasn't a good thing to do. You know, that's sort of Jiminy Cricket and his conscience. Or that, you know, gives us information, tells us things. It's not that, you know, wouldn't that be a boring job if you just had to sit in the clouds and watch, you know, some person and everything they did, and, you know, if they were doing something that was naughty, you'd have to kind of point that out, or if there was some information they needed, or if you wanted to help explain to them something about how the larger reality worked, you know, that was just it. I mean, you just sit there, watch this person all day, that'd be like an entomologist sitting down for 6 hours watching ants, you know. Crawl around an anthill. You know, you have to have a certain amount of patience for that. And we tend to think of them that way because, again, that's our metaphor for this help we get. And yes, it is consistent. And yes, they do have personalities. And yes, they do have a sense of humor. And yes, you can carry on conversations. And that personality stays the same year after year because that's your interface to the larger system. So you interact with the system that way. The system interacts with you that way. And it builds up a history, just like you build up history here. You know, the interaction between you and your guides kind of builds up a history. But the guide is just a metaphor for the help that the larger system gives us. And because we are individual entities here in this physical reality, that's how we see ourselves, then we see our guides just as a reflection of ourselves. They're independent, you know, entities. They're not physical, but they're there, and, you know, they nudge us in the right direction. They give us really neat learning dreams and other sorts of things. They sometimes give us paranormal experiences to help us see bigger pictures, and it's just the larger consciousness system trying to help us succeed.
So you started this with out-of-body experiences, and I think, you know, meditation seems to be one of the tools that can allow you to, you know, have those types of experiences. But why do we want to go out of body? Why do we want to do that?
Okay, well, that's a good question, and I touched on that earlier, saying that you don't have to. Mm-hmm. There's nothing special about out of body. It's just something that's available to you. There's nothing. You know, I say nothing special. I mean, there's no like great reward that is, you know, that you get by going out of body that you can't get without going out of body.
You don't get more spiritual merit.
No, you don't get more spiritual merit for going out of body. You don't get spiritual merit for being. It's just an experience. It's another. You live in this larger reality. You don't just live in the physical reality. Your consciousness. So you have all of this stuff extended to you. You can travel in other reality frames. You can visit these frames. There are other physical realities that aren't this physical reality, but they serve the same function. We're not the only virtual reality train. In this larger system, and you can go visit those. And there's other places, you know, like when people die, you know, they go into a non-physical, what we physical virtual reality. And now maybe before I go on, I need to talk about this physical, non-physical thing.
Sure.
Physical and non-physical is just relative to your point of view. because we're here, because we're in this data stream, we see this as physical, because this is where we're experiencing. Our dreams we see as non-physical, because they're not part of this reality. But when you're in that dream, they feel physical, don't they? When you're in a dream, you do things. You know, you run from monsters, you give speeches, you do things, and it seems to you there very physical. And when you're doing that in your dream, this reality seems non-physical. This reality doesn't exist, because now you're in a dream reality. And it's like that all over. So when you go to these different reality frames, once you're in them, they seem very, they seem physical in the sense that you're experiencing within that frame. You're in that data stream. Within that rule set, you have that experience. And all the other frames seem unphysical because you're not in them. So that's the next level of relativity, actually. Einstein said that there was no fundamental inertial frame, that all frames that are moving relative to each other are equivalent. And the next step up is there are no fundamental reality frames. All the reality frames are just relative to the observer. It depends on where you are, what's physical and what's not. So we have to get out of the idea that, well, this is the real reality, this physical one. This physical reality is no more real than your dream reality. It's no more real than any other of the dozen physical realities that are out there that you could go to, or other realities that have a less restrictive, a less constrictive rule set. And those are like the reality you run around in when you're out of body. It's just another virtual reality. All these realities are virtual realities. The only thing that's fundamental, again, is consciousness. But there's hundreds of different reality frames out there, all virtual realities. So when you die, you end up, you transfer from this virtual reality to a different virtual reality frame. It's, and that frame is set up just specifically for people to make that transition. We could go into that. There's a whole lot to talk about, when you have this thing about, theory of everything, it kind of leaves the door open for talking a very long time.
No, I think it's amazing. It's true, though. We have a lot more we could talk about, which luckily we'll have another interview next Friday, which will be great. We'll talk about some of the things we didn't talk about tonight. But yeah, it's really interesting. And so, you also talk about the void when you go into meditation. I mean, that's part of the point of trying to meditate, getting, silencing your mind and going into this void place. I mean, is that just another virtual reality as well?
Yeah, what that is, that void state, is you letting go of this physical reality. That's what it is. So your consciousness, and you're in this data stream. When you experience the void, you basically escape this data stream. Now, you can intend and go into other data streams, other reality frames, but that's what the void amounts to, and that is kind of the goal of your meditation, because the point of meditation is letting go, just being consciousness, not being a physical body, not being absorbed in the physical stimulation here, but basically letting the physical go, which is equivalent to being in a sensory deprivation tank. When you're in that state, you're unaware totally of the physical reality. You are just a point of consciousness, and there is nothing else. So that's you being you. You being fundamental consciousness without being attached to any data stream. When you are just you, then you are just a point of consciousness, and there is no data input, so it's just a void. You're in the middle of a black nowhere, and all you know is that you exist. And that's a very pleasant state. Actually, people get into that state, and they don't want to come back. It's a very pleasant place to just kind of float in that void. It's so relaxing and so fundamental. It's such a deep and wonderful experience that sometimes people kind of don't realize that that's just the first step. That's just kind of a waypoint. That's where you go first before you start exploring. You need to get to that level of point consciousness where you can let go of the physical, transfer your awareness to a no data stream at all, and then you go to other data streams.
Right.
But one thing that's interesting about this My Big Toe theory is it not only explains the things we're talking about, metaphysics and theology and Eastern philosophy and all that sort of stuff, but it also explains physics. So you have to, if you're going to explain everything, then you really have to be everything. You have to explain this physical matter reality as well. And it does that not only as a virtual trainer, but it also does some things like, for instance, physicists have no idea why reality should be probability waves, but quantum mechanics says that's the way it is. It's probability waves. We know that if we assume that, we can calculate correct answers that experiments verify, but nobody knows why that should be. Why is it that reality is a probability wave? You know, why does it work that way? Well, this theory just, you know, derives quantum mechanics. It also derives, you know, why the speed of light is a constant invariant of the motion of the source, and that is the fact that created special relativity. So both relativity and quantum mechanics are natural derivations of this virtual reality model of mine, as well as the things we've been talking about, which is more the metaphysics. They all come out of the same theory from a, you know, a logical derivation.
Wow. Well, you've been a delight, Tom. Why don't you talk a little bit about your workshop coming up? What do your workshops usually entail?
All right. Giving me a chance to do a little plug here.
There you go.
That's good. I'm having a workshop Saturday and Sunday coming up soon, the 22nd and 23rd of August. This is going to be in Toronto, Ontario, at the Ryerson University.
That's right.
You can go to www.mbtevents.com, and that's where they'll have descriptions of what's going on and where and how and hotels and how to sign up and that sort of thing. But what we do there is I spend the first couple of hours just explaining the nature of reality. You know, how does reality work? What's it, you know, what's it made of? Kind of the mechanics of reality. And then after that, we discuss what's it like in the larger reality. You know, when you get out of this frame and you go into other frames, what's that like? What's that experience? What are its boundaries? What do you, you know, what can you do there? What can't you do? Then I go into some experiential things because people are often very interested in how to heal others, you know, how to go out of body, how to, you know, remote view, and these sorts of things are very attractive. You know, they're like attractive flowers, you know, they bring people in. People are interested in this sort of thing.
They are.
So that's what brings them in. That's why they're there, because they want to learn how to do this neat stuff. Even though that's kind of off the path of lowering your entropy, they, you know, it's a big attractor.
Yeah.
So we talk about that, and I give them some ideas and techniques and things that they can do. And mostly, it surprises them. Even though some of them have been doing this stuff for you know 20 years, I often tell them things that kind of surprise them, because they've been doing their own little tool sets and rituals and things, and they realize that none of those are necessary. That there's a lot of shortcuts that they can make. So we do some of that, and then we go back to talking about the how to experience the larger reality. You know, what's there, the things, you know, where are the boogeymen, you know, what do you do about them, and so on. We just kind of talk in general what people are interested in, and I try to leave room for lots of questions so people can kind of get their own personal questions answered. So that's
nice.
Really mostly what it's about.
Very nice. Well, I hope... not only the Toronto one, but you have another one, too, that, you know, they all get...
After Toronto, the next one's in London, England.
Nice.
And, yeah, I'm kind of on a little international kick here for a while. You know, I just did one in Asheville, North Carolina, and before that I was in Austin, Texas. And now it's Toronto and London. London is the 10th and 11th of October. And, again, go to that same www.mbtevents.com to find out about them. And if you want to find out about me and my books, that's www.mybigtoe.com. My big toe, all one word.
Perfect.
So that's where more information is. Then after London next year in February, we're going to go to California, and we're going to go two venues in California, and then we have a bunch more planned, to kind of one in the Midwest, and then like one in Florida, and a few other things.
Great.
People are very. I have a lot of invitations to come and speak. People are very interested in this because it explains their experiences. You know, people have these experiences, and they don't know what to make of them. Pretty much the way Bob Monroe was in the beginning. It's like, you know, am I making this up? You know, am I nuts? You know, what's going on here? And then they hear this theory, and they realize that it's just part of the natural world. It's just the way things are. The paranormal is not really paranormal. You know, it's all normal.
Yeah.
You just have to have a bigger picture in which it's all normal. It's paranormal inside this little picture that we're in, but from a bigger picture, it's all just normal and understandable and actually very logical.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. I probably overrun your time.
That's okay.
I?
Just a little bit.
Yeah, we're we're 4 minutes past the top of the hour. Oh, well. Slap my fingers. Yeah. I went too long.
That's okay. I didn't want to stop you. All right. So I guess I will talk to you next Friday.
Next Friday. Mm-hmm. It'll be a date. Had a good time, Lori.
Thank you
very much for the invitation.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.